My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to this week's Mysteries and Monsters. This week's show once again delves into the paranormal as I discuss American poltergeist cases with our esteemed guest, Alison Jornman. Alison is well known in paranormal and cryptozoological circles and has appeared on countless TV shows and podcasts in the last decade. We cover poltergeists in America, as well as taking a detour via Point Pleasant, as well as touching on some cryptids as well. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. Once again, thank you for your lovely reviews and emails we've received recently. It really helps us grow and reach a new audience. So please keep those nice reviews coming along and keep dropping those emails to us. You can always drop in us a line at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com with any feedback, guest suggestions, or if you'd like to appear on the show. You can find us on all social media platforms. Mysteries and Monsters on Facebook. We're Mystery Monsters on Twitter and Instagram, as well as subscribing to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. March is coming up and it's our 1 year anniversary. So we have a couple of bonus episodes coming along on top of the regular weekly episodes. So keep an eye out for those coming up next month. Right, it's time to join Alison Jornman. My guest today is American paranormal investigator, Alison Jornman. Alison has been investigating strange phenomena for over 20 years. She developed Milwaukee's first haunted history tour back in 2008, and since then Alison has led numerous tours and presented talks on a variety of Fortean topics, including poltergeists, fairies, UFOs, cryptids, demon possession, and much, much more. Alison currently works as a professional weirdo, writing articles for a variety of publications, developing haunted history tours for AmericanGhostWalks.com, and is awaiting the birth of her first book. Alison, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. We're delighted that you've joined us other weirdos on the other side of the Atlantic.
Oh, I am always glad to talk to somebody over in the UK. Thank you so much, Paul, for having me today.
Hey, my pleasure. Been looking forward to speaking to you for quite a while, because you're someone that I've kept up to date with and followed your career over the last couple of years, obviously with some of your other appearances on podcasts and TV and things. So, how on earth did you end up discovering your inner weirdo, Alison?
Oh, man. Well, I think that probably goes back to fourth grade, maybe age 10, 9, 10, where I just discovered the concepts of UFOs and ghosts and cryptozoology. And there was actually an Osborne book that was just reissued on the topic of ghosts, which I bought for myself and, you know, a bunch of other people for Christmas, because I actually that book was came out in the UK. We did have a copy of it in our local library in Big Bend, Wisconsin. Mm. And so I'm not sure how that happened exactly, but, you know, it's a worldwide publication, I'm sure, Osborne Books. But I actually recall some of the pictures in that book. When I reordered it to distribute amongst my friends, I was thrilled to reread it as a 50-year-old now. And I was like, oh, my God, I still remember some of this book, 40 years later. So I think books like that really inspired me to read more and find out if there was anything to these mysteries. And then later on, and this sounds pretty dated too. Although this was happening in the 80s, it sounds like it was happening in the 30s or 40s. When my mother, around Halloween time, she really loved listening to Chicago radio stations, even though we lived in Wisconsin. And so during Halloween, Chicagoland had a ghost hunter named Richard Crow. And every time Halloween would roll around, she would gather my brother and myself around the radio, and we listened to Tales of Haunted Chicagoland. And that was like a huge thrill for both of us. And then in later on, myself and then my brother, years later, developed ghost tours for our different cities, inspired by Richard Crow, who was not only a ghost expert, but also started the first haunted history tours in the United States in 1973. And that was the same year where they started when they started the London Ghost Walk as well. So it was something, a tradition that we wanted to carry on. So I think those are my two influences, reading and Richard Crow from Chicago.
Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned the Usborne book because I did exactly the same thing because I saw it was being re-released.
Yeah,
And it was a
I read
book.
about it in 40 times.
Well, exactly same here. And obviously I'm a member of the 14 Times Facebook group, so we were all getting very excited on there about it coming back, and I was exactly the same as you. There was like a sense of palpable excitement as a 47-year-old man when that turned up from Amazon, Alison, and I opened it up,
Yes.
and I could still the two images that have always stuck with me was the smoke ghost that's in the first couple of pages and the ghostly highwayman. And as soon
Oh,
as I saw
wow.
and as soon as I it was literally like taking a step back in time. It was almost as if I was reading that book again for the first time. It's a wonderful book.
Right. So those images kind of are ingrained in our memory. For me, it was the black shuck with
Yes.
the cyclopean eye in the
Yes.
center of his forehead. That one, I was like, oh, I remember this one. And then secondly was the bear in the native headdress.
Yes.
Those are two that I was like, I know I read this book before, because
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's peeping at me
it's
off my
amazing
bookshelf at the
after 40
moment.
years that that can come back so clearly.
It is. It just shows you, I think, when you get that kind of attachment to something, I think when you're that kind of age, you're quite thirsty for exciting things. And it's weird
Absolutely.
how much it sticks to your soul that 40 years down the line, you're like, oh my goodness, here we go again. Let's hope they re-release because I think it's been a massive success because I know there's actually a trilogy of books. And
Yes, that's true.
because I think there's a UFO one and is the other one about
And a
monsters?
cryptozoology one.
Yeah, the one with Nessie.
It's called Monsters. I know it because I actually brought my brother the ghost book reissue, and then I was like, well, what about the other ones? And then so I bought him the ghost book reissue for his birthday, and then when Christmas came around, I actually went to Abe Books and got a used copy of the other two Osborne books from the series. He has a young daughter, and so the idea is I'm seeding the next generation. So they were for him and for her a little bit later on. So yeah, these things have been a huge inspiration in our lives, and that's why we started the tour company American Ghost Walks. So we're doing quite well right now, and we actually just launched a new tour in San Juan, Puerto Rico, which didn't have a ghost tour. And we were like, what? There's such incredible history there that I was able to write a haunted history tour, and we recently started offering them there in San Juan, Puerto Rico. So we're branching out.
Fabulous. Yeah, I think that's quite an interesting trend as well because it's something that seems to have developed. I mean, there's obviously several famous ones in London that you can kind of go on. And it seemed to be mostly in major cities, sort of in the 80s and 90s, Alison. But I think over the last sort of 10, 15 years, it seems, because we've got a couple in Sheffield that run 3 times a week. So, and they do different
Wow,
things.
3 times a week. Holy cow.
So yeah, and he turns up. He's called oh, I've forgotten his name now, but he wears top hat and a big cape and a cane and everything. He proper embraces the whole ghost walk tour.
Well, the great thing about ghost stories, I find, is that they've been a traditional way to learn about the past, to carry on the past, and remember the dead. And so, definitely, that's what we aim to do on our ghost tours, is to respect the dead and, make sure the memories of them and what they did lived on, and may also live on in other ways, like in spirit form. There's certainly so many stories of ghosts and poltergeist all over the world, and it's just a canon of such amazing literature that I don't know. I think it touches something in us that's uniquely human, and that's why they're so powerful. But I should also say that my brother and I are both very interested in parapsychology as well. And then when the Ghostbusters movie came out, certainly that was a comedy. But Dan Aykroyd does actually study parapsychology, and his family has been very involved in spiritualism for many generations, and so he came to it with a certain knowledge. And so my brother and I were both so sad to know that, there's really nowhere in this country where you can certify as a parapsychologist. You have to come over to the UK to do that. So maybe one of these days. One of these days we'll get to Edinburgh. But yeah, so we took the ghost walk route, but that doesn't mean that we're not interested in real investigation. We certainly are.
Yeah, I think Dan, like as you touched on, Dan Aykroyd's a very interesting man, because I think it's only over the last few years that he's kind of been very open about his family history. And I mean, obviously, anybody who was obsessed with Ghostbusters, like I think most people of our age were, Alison, when it came out.
Yes.
So his family, I think his parents were fully on board in as parapsychologists, weren't they? So he basically grew up in a family that were very comfortable talking about spiritualism and parapsychology and hauntings and ghosts.
Absolutely. And his father actually has a book, I believe it's called The History of Ghosts, and I actually have a copy of it on my phone.
Oh.
Never go anywhere without it. But yeah, so if people really want to know more about his history in the paranormal and, the history of spiritualism in America, it's a great read.
Brilliant. I'll try and pick up a copy, because it certainly whetted my appetite to learn a lot more about his parents, because it sounds a really interesting life story.
Yeah, because it really goes even further back in the family than that. So, he has, like, as I said, like, generations of people in his family have been involved in the search.
Yeah, I know, as we touched on when I was introducing you, we mentioned a subject that's clearly dear to both of our hearts, which is poltergeist, Alison.
Yes,
And
poltergeists are my favorite.
so I've always been, to my shame, there aren't, I'll be honest, there are only probably 2 or 3 notable American cases I'm aware of.
Oh.
Obviously, I mean, you could probably consider the Bell Witch as probably, I would say, one of the most famous.
Yes, definitely.
And I'm trying to think, there was a, as I'm sure you will probably remember, the American mystery show in the 90s, Sightings, where they had a poltergeist that liked to scratch a family that were there. And they had,
Oh
basically had,
yes, that was a Sally House
that's
in
it.
Atchison, Kansas. Right.
Yeah. So what would you say to someone like me, who, to his shame, doesn't know as much as he should about American poltergeist? What kind of cases do you think are the ones that make you sit up and take notice that there's something clearly very strange going on in these incidents?
Well, See, the thing to me that really comes clear is the consistency of the reports over time and space. And I do have researchers that I work with, other paranormal investigators, even one who actually works as a scientist during the day and investigates hauntings at night. So I work with other investigators who, sometimes will tell me that they dismiss poltergeist cases as fraud, like all of them, just out of hand. And for me, that I know there has been fraud mixed in, and some cases, are of anything are gonna involve fraud. It doesn't have to be poltergeists. There's just fraud in human life. So what I try to tell people like that is when you look deeply at the cases, you see that similarities keep popping up again and again throughout history. And why would there be that kind of consistency all the way back to antiquity if something was merely fraud perpetrated by some naughty kids? I think there's something going on there. Sometimes what goes on is so weird that we don't know what to make of it. I mean, I think that other hauntings, what distinguishes a poltergeist case perhaps more than other cases of hauntings is just the ridiculous nature of some of the phenomena. And so where sometimes you're haunted by a spirit that talks to you or interacts in a way that humans can understand. In poltergeist cases, that's not necessarily the case. You could go in your closet and your clothes are all shredded. Stuff is flying around the kitchen. In Scotland, there's something called clodding, which is a rain of peat moss, which just hits the house for some reason. And in a multitude of cases, in where all paranormal phenomena is involved, there have been people who have experienced stone throwing, like stones just come out of nowhere. So like the clodding, like the rain of peat moss, you can also have a rain of stones. So there's really strange things that happen. Which leave us scratching our heads and trying to understand what exactly happened there and what perpetrated it. I mean, there's been many ideas of the possible causes for poltergeists over the centuries. And I should mention too, I mean, we know that word. A lot of people know that word, poltergeist, which essentially means noisy ghost, and refers to that chaotic, cacophonous, house-wrecking nature of the poltergeist phenomena. So a lot of people are familiar with that, but you might not be familiar with some other history. Like the word was first coined in 1638, and then later would be popularized by Martin Luther, who described the term in his religious writings. And then someone who usually doesn't get the credit, who really should, is the authoress Catherine Crowe, who in 1848, she actually had been reading all these incredible German texts. And this is something that I'd like to see a lot more in the paranormal, where people are not so ethnocentric, but really they're reaching out to other cultures and seeing what's going on there. Are they having the same or different experiences and seeing what can be learned from that? Well, Catherine Crowe, a woman in the 1840s, that was a time when you couldn't, as a woman, you couldn't vote, you couldn't own property. And here she was, living in Kent and left her husband and moved all the way to Edinburgh and started a writing career. So she was a mystery writer, but then she had been reading, like I said, all these German texts by philosophers and physicians and other theorists who were coming up with some amazing phenomena. And she was like, I have to write a book about this. And so firstly, what she did is she translated a book called The Seeress of Prevorst. in 1845, and which was a work by a German author, and about an incredible medium, and you know some of the things that she was able to foretell, and also the poltergeist phenomena that surrounded her. And then in 1848, she wrote the book The Night Side of Nature, which introduced the term poltergeist to the English-speaking audience and chronicled many cases world over. And I mean, that's really still an incredible book today. People should definitely check it out because it is public domain now, out of copyright, so anybody could be reading it right now. And I would definitely say that book is ahead of its time. And if you haven't read it, you definitely should. So the first recorded poltergeist case goes back to the 4th century, according to Christopher Larson, who wrote his PhD dissertation on the history of poltergeist phenomena. So he actually has a PhD in poltergeists. So he found a workaround. You know, he couldn't be a parapsychologist, but he could get a degree at the University of British Columbia in history, and he studied the history of poltergeist. So, but other sources attest that the accounts of poltergeist actually at least date back to ancient Greece. So they've been with us forever. But what are they? So we were talking off air about Geoffrey Holder and his incredible book, Poltergeist Over Scotland, which,
Fabulous.
yeah, I mean, that's a great book because he takes 134 cases just in Scotland. Scotland's not that big. You know what I mean? So for him to be able to study 134 cases, I mean, it was incredible. And he only found, and we were talking about the, you know, possibility of hoaxing, and he only found in the cases that he studied, 4.5% involved hoaxing, whereas the analyses of other researchers of, you know, the meta-analyses of, you know, hundreds of poltergeist cases indicate numbers of somewhere between 3% and 15% being fraud related or having hoaxing involved. So, I mean, to me, to suggest that all these cases across history and across cultures are just the work of hoaxers or naughty children, you really don't have a leg to stand on. But what are they? That's really the question.
I mean, Jeff's book's fascinating as well on a cultural perspective, Alison, because it's really interesting because obviously when because the book goes back to the 15th 17th century, and essentially the only educated people in the areas that these alleged hauntings and poltergeist activities were occurring were the people of religious following. So it was usually the local parson or vicar or priest or whoever. And what struck me about Jeff's book is the fact that you can see where the culture it shifts from kind of being religious to scientific to just then becoming cultural. Did you notice looking at, say, American cases, did you notice a kind of trend in regards to the way that they were reported going back to sort of 18th and 19th century cases?
Well, I think, you know, like we were mentioning the Bell Witch from Tennessee, and I mean that case, because it involves some kind of entity which actually speaks to people. I mean, it also throws things around, you know, assaults people. But, you know, beyond that is having detailed conversations with people about scripture. So, I mean, this is a curious case because it and many of the other cases that we'll talk about today, I mean, they may involve a human agent, but they may not. Like some of the cases that I've studied, you know, it clearly seems like there's a human agent involved, which is the popular hypothesis today that these aren't ghosts, these aren't any kind of entities or demons or fairies. You know, none of the explanations of the the past need apply. So now we're all scientific, and we think that it's RSPK, or a recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, the new, you know, the newer buzzword for the phenomena. We don't call it poltergeist anymore. We think it's actually the mind of the human agent wreaking all this havoc because of some kind of abnormal stress response. So, I mean, this is the most popular idea about poltergeist cases. But, you know, going back to Jeff Holder, I mean, when he investigated those 134 cases, he found that only about 1/4 to 1/3 of the poltergeists actually had a human agent involved.
Yes.
So it's not uniform.
Yeah.
So as much as we'd like to make it uniform, it isn't.
Absolutely.
So, certainly, in the case of the Bell Witch, I mean, that really seemed like an entity, but it acts like a poltergeist in the destruction that it was able to cause. And it did, the Bell Witch did have a certain fascination with one of the daughters.
Mm.
So the Bell Witch did focus its assaults and other manifestations around a certain member of the family.
Yeah.
So that's curious because, I mean, when an entity is talking to you, it doesn't seem like PK. It doesn't seem like psychokinesis. It seems like there's an entity there. You know, did that girl really have so much knowledge over, you know, about the scripture to talk about them in such erudite terms as have been ascribed to the Bell Witch?
Mm.
Questionable, right?
Yeah.
So, and then there's a, you know, there's a corresponding case in England, the Geth, the talking mongoose.
Yes.
That is similar too.
Brilliant.
I mean, although it's like ascribed to not a witch this time, but, you know, a scruffy animal. But again, that, you know, that's very similar to the Bell Witch case because there's so much conversation going on with an entity.
Yeah, very much so. He's a real character as well. It's one of my favorite cases, even if it's all nonsense, Alison. It's one of my favorite cases because it's so weird. I mean, and I love things like he used to tell them he'd jump on the local bus and go into the village, and then he'd come back with all the gossip and tell all the family and sing along, and I like sugar and biscuits. I mean, it's just a really weird, a wonderfully weird story. It's brilliant.
Oh, it is. And you think that it's so clever that it's hard to believe that it's made up. I mean, maybe there was a budding novelist there in the family that was the cause of it. But I, you know, the story, as you say, is just so entertaining. But I have some stories here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I'm from.
Yeah.
I was just really excited to find local cases because that's what's really compelling to me. You know, I read about cases elsewhere all over the world. And then I'm like, hey, what about here? Have we had cases here? Mm. And so I was like, wow, we have had cases here. And it's interesting how they line up. Now, you know, when we were talking about Catherine Crow, so, you know, some of the cases I'm going to be talking about today, you'll see that they kind of blend sometimes with possible cases of demonic possession or demonic oppression. And what's interesting is in The Night Side of Nature, that great book by Catherine Crow, in her chapter on poltergeist, she also covers demonic possession. So the two do seem to be somehow related. And perhaps what we're seeing is that the human agent is in some way being harassed by an entity. So we have a case from 1874 from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that is called the Giddings Poltergeist. So this case centered on a place called the Giddings Boarding House. And so this was a place in the city that people could come and board, and the people boarding there were actually workers at a local tannery. And so everything was fine until one day it wasn't, and stuff was flying around the kitchen, and pies were exploding. All kinds of crazy stuff was going on. And they didn't know, what was the cause of it. I mean, in a lot of these cases, I mean, people have no idea that anything like this has ever happened before. They're just kind of like going about their life, and then, pots and pans are flying. And this case had multiple witnesses where people from the local newspapers came and witnessed the phenomena. Of course, the tycoon who actually owned the tannery, he was a prominent person in the community named George Allen. He came to check out what was going on because it was affecting his workers. I mean, that's where his workers stayed, at the Giddings boarding house. And, that was a threat to him that, he might have to find another place for them. So, when he actually entered the home, he saw a log from the fireplace lift itself up and smash itself into his leg. So, I mean, and he reported that, yes, I did see these things. These things did happen. So sadly, what Mrs. Giddings soon discovered is that these strange things only happened when Mary Spiegel, a poor little Polish girl, was present. So, this job was really important to her, but because these things only happened when she was around, she was fired. Now, for that, she was severely beaten by her father and soon attempted suicide by jumping in the river. Now, thankfully, a passerby was able to jump into the river and save her, and she was remanded to the care of a doctor in the city who said that, she was recovering. And this goes to the point that, perhaps in this case, at least, it was some kind of human agent at work, because the manifestations were short-lived. And when she was taken out of her, stressful home where, she had, a father that would beat her, as was the case, these manifestations ceased. They don't talk about them troubling the doctor who was caring for her. And then later on, she was given back to her mother, and then from that, she just falls from the spotlight. So, I mean, this was a case that made national news here in the United States, and there's similar cases all over the United States like this. Recently, when I spoke at in Hawaii for Hawaii Paracon, I found an almost identical case to this case that I just told you in Hawaii, on the island of Oahu. There was a young girl who was in a similar situation, and her case is called the Punch Bowl Poltergeist. And that's because the area where she lived is called Punch Bowl. And anyway, the story is very, very similar to Mary Spiegel's story. I also have another story from Milwaukee, which this one seems a little bit more suspicious, but it is a fun story. It's from 1923. There was a family called the Gottfrieds that were living on Sherman Street in Milwaukee, and their house was suddenly besieged by strange events. And family members witnessed like household items flying around the kitchen. The kids were complaining that, the pillows would leap off the bed and hit them in the face. And then they actually labeled this event the swearing ghost, because strange notes seemed to float from the ceiling. And when you read them, they were full of obscenities. And then later on, there were also obscenities etched across the walls in the home. So the father doesn't know what to do, and he calls police. And this was when a time when police actually did come out, and they came out. They sent someone called an alienist, which an alienist was somebody who would come and try to assess the situation and assess if there was any mental illness involved, for example. So they sent this alienist, and the alienist observed, different phenomena, and then actually sent the eldest daughter in the family, Clara, away to live at a children's home. And then some say that the strange manifestation ceased, but then there were later Milwaukee Journal articles which reported that the strange activity continued to afflict the family even after Clara's departure. So, I mean, you think maybe it's just kids. Like in this case, it sounds like that would be a thing for kids to do, to scrawl some obscenities across a paper and throw them up in the air. But still, even with that, you wonder like how the parents would miss that. I mean, I was a elementary school teacher for 13 years, and you gotta have eyes in the back of your head, and any parent knows that as well. So it's strange. These stories, it really doesn't seem to be just somebody throwing things around, because usually in cases where that happens, they're eventually caught. And in the two cases I just talked about, no one was caught. You know what? There's another case, which happened in the 20s too, that I want to mention to you. Now, this one, again, it doesn't have an agent, and I think I'm going to classify it as a poltergeist because of the regularity and severity of the manifestations. So, in the 1920s, there was this older woman named Minnie Plants, who she lived in Milwaukee, on the outskirts with her daughters and her a son-in-law. And what began happening is all of a sudden, there were knockings on the walls at all hours of the night. So out of nowhere, these manifestations started where there was pounding and knocking on the walls, and nobody could get any sleep. And so they called in the cops. And again, the cops came. And it's interesting to read these articles about what happened because police officers were mentioned in the article as actually experiencing some of the phenomena. So not only did they hear these loud knockings and poundings in the house, but they saw like strange balls of light that would materialize from the ground and then ascend up in the air. And so they didn't know what to do with that, but they were there. They tried to mount a search for a possible perpetrator because the son-in-law also reported that one day he was one evening he was just outside for a smoke, and some unseen hands pulled him into the bushes and beat him quite severely. And he didn't see who it was. There was nobody there, he said. It was as he was being beaten by an invisible man. And so the police, what could they do? They came, they saw, they actually noticed that after the poundings had commenced, they surrounded the house and noticed that there were huge footprints. Size E 11 EE, I believe. I don't know how that big that is, but it's a pretty big
No,
foot,
me
apparently.
either, yeah.
Yes. Anyway, so these huge footprints were around the house, male shoe print. And so they launched this Cinderellian search around the neighborhood to try to find the big-footed perpetrator. And so they went door to door. And of course, they didn't find anybody. And what do you do after that? Nothing. So what could they do? So later on, I was happy to receive a call from one of her relatives. Years later, I put the story on my blog and asking for more information because sadly with, a lot of these stories like the ones I recounted tonight.
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
They will, come onto the scene, and then you just lose track. I mean, these people fall out of the spotlight, and you can't find anything more about the case. And so regarding this mini plants case, I asked on my blog, hey, if anybody has information, please give me a call. And one of her descendants actually called me because he had been doing some genealogy and he was just Googling around putting names of different family members in the search engine and came up with the story from my blog. And all these memories flooded back to him in that, you know, when he was a child, he had heard of Aunt Minnie, but she was always spoken about in hushed tones. So as a child, he was always scrambling for more information.
Yes.
And was really, kind of met with chagrin when he saw my article, because he was like, what? There was a newspaper? There were newspaper articles? I did not know this. And so he was able to tell me the other side of the story. So everybody, like in the family, was just like ashamed of what happened there, and treated Minnie, kind of like she was crazy. And however, these were the descendants, so they lacked some of the knowledge of what had happened way back when. But he was able to talk to some of the people that remembered, what had transpired. And he talked about these manifestations continuing until the day she died. So this wasn't short-lived, like most poltergeist cases. This went on for decades. And the thing that I didn't know that he was able to fill in, well, I'll share that in a moment. But before I say that, I don't want to get ahead of myself here. Before I say that, I want to tell that, okay, so her family grew up, they moved out, and she's all alone in the house. And these things keep happening. And she has a hard time sleeping at night because of the resounding knocks and cacophony that's going on until dawn. And so, sadly, although her family wanted to help her and, different members of the family would stay with her at different times, they had to work. So, they weren't able to make a habit of it. So a lot of times she was just left alone in the house with that thing. And what I would find out from her descendant is that Minnie's husband had died 10 years prior to the manifestations. Now, Minnie's husband had been very abusive to her in life. He had been a drinker and had beaten her. And then he died. And then for some reason, 10 years after his death, these manifestations started. Now, the thing that maybe shows that this is him come back from the grave to wreak some kind of revenge is that he had very, very large feet. So, that's an extraordinary story that really happened in Milwaukee.
Yeah. I mean, it is unusual that essentially that kind of stretches the parameters as you refer to, because most poltergeist cases are quite intense over a short period of time, maybe between a year and 2 years, Alison, in the majority of cases I've certainly come across. So for anything to kind of go past that 2-year threshold, it's either a really unique poltergeist case, or perhaps it's clearly something else that's just a collection of phenomena.
Yeah, and who knows? I mean, we very much don't know what poltergeists are. I mean, we try to put a label on it, you know, as, like I said, RSPK. But, you know, clearly all these different phenomena like fire starting and, you know, water coming out of the ceiling spontaneously and rains of stones and let's say, you know, you open your closet and all your clothes are ripped to shreds. You know, all these things, you know, they don't seem to be something that occurs in a regular haunting.
Mm. Yeah, it seems to be very different. And I think some poltergeist cases are very similar, but there are some lovely, unique ones where, you know, as we've mentioned, Geoff, who lived on the Isle of Man, who was a very unique case. And there's always, I always like the ones that seem to be able to find money from somewhere and deliver it to, as though it's a kind of compensationary payment for their mischief.
Right. I mean, okay, that's the poltergeist I want.
Yeah.
Bring me money and I don't care what else you do.
Yeah. One that does
that's
the housework.
Awesome. So we were talking off air about, you know, some experiences that you had when you were growing up, and, you know, you grew up in a haunted house. Now, yeah. Again, poltergeists usually are short-lived phenomena, but, you know, occasionally the moniker of poltergeist is put on to phenomena, you know, a phenomenon such as scratching and, you know, other like physical attacks. Mm. And you had some physicality with your haunting.
Yeah, it was a very varied thing, like we were saying, Alison. You know, we had the usual things moving around and stuff happening, things turning on and off, doors opening and closing. But the one incident that will always stand out is the mine is when I was going to the bathroom and I was pushed from behind and fell into the toilet, broke my cheekbone. And man, that was probably the most violent outburst of it all. But it was more, I wouldn't necessarily say malicious, because that was the worst anything happened. The rest of it was all pretty, well, I say standard stuff. I don't say carpets rolling up in the middle of the night are normal behavior.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, talk about that. I mean, that seems like a poltergeist type thing. You know,
yeah,
it's mischief.
Absolutely. So that my parents went to bed, and in the morning when they woke up, the carpet had been rolled up under the bed. But to do that, you would have to lift the bed. But
yeah,
they had absolutely no recollection. And it was a converted vicarage. It was literally 20 yards away from the church in the village. So from the front room, you could just about see the graveyard out the front window across the road. And when we were doing some gardening, my father found a gravestone in the front garden. And it was just a very, very strange house. It had its own atmosphere, if that makes sense. It seemed to be more than just an old house.
Right. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, what's your read on it? Do you think that was a poltergeist, or do you think like long-lived phenomena, like, for example, in Greyfriars Kirk, you know, they call the manifestations going on there with all the scratching and bruising and such that's been going on for quite a number of years now. You know, they call that the Mackenzie poltergeist. Now, to you, is that a misnomer, or is that a poltergeist case?
Yeah, I think it is, because I think unless you really dive into the cases in full and look at the history of what we would term poltergeist, if we're going to try and pigeon them whole in some aspect, Alison, I think once it goes past 2 years, I think that seems to be something else, because all the big cases are very explosive, very intense. They tend to start slowly and reach a crescendo and then slowly sort of dissipate, like coming up and down a mountain. essentially, over a period of time, where I think anything that goes past 2 or 3 years, I mean, we were there 4 years and we had stuff happen throughout that period constantly. So for me, anything past that, I tend to start thinking, well, that's perhaps some kind of haunting, but certainly one that's more more visible, if that makes sense.
Yeah, more in your face.
Yeah, very much so.
Able to really cause some damage. So what do you make of this case? So I call it the attack of the breakfast foods. So it's actually occurred in Illinois, mm-hmm. in 1883, and it was written up in the Dunkirk Evening Observer in Dunkirk, New York, on May 31st in 1883. Okay, so in Marshall, Illinois, there was a bishop that was dealing with the case of a diabolical possession of a 15-year-old girl. Mm. So she was apparently eventually cured by a priest a few years before, and the account given to the priest was that the girl, when she was 3 years old, ate some toast and molasses, afterward complained of uneasiness in her stomach, and from that time forward became melancholy. So toast and molasses, clearly eat. So no one out there, eat toast with molasses.
Okay.
You've been warned. So as she grew older, she became more abusive to her parents. And then suddenly there was a voice that came out of her, and it assumed the deep growl of a dog. Mm-hmm. Now, so to see if it was really the devil, the priest said in Latin, "I command thee in the name of Jesus Christ to tell me who thou art." And whereupon a deep voice replied in French, "I am the devil." Ooh, so we got Latin and French. Awesome.
Show it off. Show it off.
"I command thee to tell me who you are," said the priest. And let's see. "Thou art a black beast, a priest coming a priest coming to torment me," said the devil, apparently out of this girl.
Yeah.
Now, then the priest actually had breakfast in the same house. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, as he sat down to breakfast, there was a rain of worms coming from the ceiling that spoiled his Wheaties entirely. So what do you think of something like that? I mean, it has like the rain of worms, and it has you know, the strange voices emanating from the girl, which they can be something that happens during a poltergeist case. But again, where do we draw the line between a poltergeist and a demonic possession?
Yeah, very true. I mean, it's quite interesting as well, because they are things that you would prescribe more towards a demonic possession, because obviously the speaking in tongues is usually a clear sign of this. Often these, what I always find remarkable, as you referred to in regards to one of the previous cases we're discussing, is the Bell Witch. It was the level of intelligence and knowledge that these alleged children were able to give voice to, which would belie the fact of the era, and most children were probably not educated, so they probably didn't have access to any of these languages or pieces of knowledge or scripture or whatever.
All right.
So where does that kind of catalyst come from them to be able to respond in such a way? I think that's always a really interesting aspect of it, because these days you can say, oh, well, perhaps they've Googled it, or they've read about it, or they've seen it on YouTube. Whereas 100 years, you know, without wanting to state the obvious, people simply didn't have the access to this information, or even other cases around the country at the same time.
Yes, I mean, they didn't have access to this kind of news. So yes, I mean, you are right. The Catholic Church has four signs of possession. And one of the signs is, you know, the speaking in tongues, as you say, being able to understand or speak in foreign languages that are unknown to the agent. And yeah, so that definitely distinguishes this case. And so here's another case for you. 1988 is the Gallo case from Chicago, Illinois. So mysterious fires started erupting in an Orland Hills home, and they were blamed on a 14-year-old girl. And authorities could not explain how ordinary electrical sockets turned into blowtorches. So this little, you know, 14-year-old girl, these strange manifestations surround her where, you know, these fires start spontaneously. And so they actually, this is a modern case where authorities were involved, where they actually sent in, you know, people from the police, people from the insurance company, to see what's causing this. Is it, you know, natural gas or methane gas? Is it some kind of leak? And they couldn't come up with a logical explanation. All these fires were starting spontaneously. And, you know, one of the most dramatic parts was when a blue flame, an inch in diameter, shot out of one of the wall sockets for more than 30 seconds. And so there were other, you know, manifestations that, you know, made them believe that this was not something that could be explained. So essentially, you know, they went in thinking it could be explained, and then nobody could find a reason for it. And, you know, they noticed that when the little girl wasn't there, these manifestations weren't happening. And so what they eventually had to do is they bulldozed the house, and the insurance company paid for a new house.
Wow.
So and again, they did blame it on the girl, because when the girl wasn't there, it didn't happen. But clearly, you know, the girl wasn't, you know, some kind of engineer who could think about, like, well, how could I turn a light socket into a blowtorch? I mean,
well, exactly.
I wouldn't know how to do that.
I mean, that's something that often perplexes me when people say, oh, yeah, it's clearly a hoax, because there are several notable poltergeist cases where there's been severe damage to electrical outputs. And
right.
Anybody trying to mess around with that, I refuse to believe that any teenager doesn't realise that sticking something metal into a plug socket, I don't care what country you're in, there's usually one result to that, and it's not burn it. Yeah, you might burn the circuit out or blow the plug up, but there's usually another end result, and that's usually you getting electrocuted and dying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh.
So, you know, there are cases like that as well, where it's like the manifestations aren't always what you'd expect.
Yeah, very true.
And but again, you know, there's multiple manifestations, but they do, you know, in this case, they did call in authorities, and they eventually just had to bulldoze the house. And I guess they were able to overcome that in future. You know, it didn't follow her along, her around, thankfully. But again, you know, what is causing these strange manifestations? These it's just the phenomena is ridiculous and nonsensical in many cases.
I think that's why we love it so much, because it's it defies all laws of nature and physics. You know, it's just incredible sometimes what happens. And I often find it frustrating as well when the usual it's teenagers hoaxing it. And it tends to sort of ignore Enfield's a prime example of that, the Enfield poltergeist in North London, because one of the first pairs of witnesses to the events were two police officers. And it's almost as if people just pick out bits of information from certain cases and say, oh, well, that clearly proves it's a hoax, and disregard everybody else. Because Why should we disregard a police officer because he sees or they see something peculiar, Alison? But if they stood up in a court of law and gave evidence, it's taken down. So what's the difference? Yes. Is it just because it's something that is scientifically impossible? Because surely you have to judge that person on the character of the witness.
Right. And, you know, I do need to interject here that, you know, there's certain modern cases, you know, not involving poltergeists, involving other things where people always want to attest that a police officer was witness to the events.
Yes.
And the reason that they want to do that is because of the credibility factor.
Mm.
And, you know, sometimes that's bogus in terms of, you know, people posturing, trying to say that there's evidence for something that there isn't. But in these cases that we've been talking about, you know, we have the benefit of history and records.
Mm.
And we can see clearly that authorities were involved in many of these cases.
Mm.
And that, you know, they had regular lives just like we do. And something extraordinary happened just this one time that defies explanation.
Absolutely. I always love listening to stories. I've had a gentleman on my show a couple of times called Andy Gilbert, who's an ex-police officer, and he's released two books that are all first-person accounts of police officers in the United Kingdom with spooky goings-on, and they're fantastic.
Yes, I love police stories. You know, that's why, you know, we have to watch that, you know, because people know it is a credibility factor. We have to make sure that it's coming from accredited sources and, you know, that we have proper documentation. But once you do, I mean, that really sells it for me.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's usually what seals the deal as well for me. You know, and it's the same as you could say with the obviously, the Tic Tac videos that have come out, the fact that these are Navy personnel that are saying this and fighter pilots and people used to handling multi-million dollar machines. It's just taken that particular incident to a different level for me, I think.
Yes. I mean, they have a familiarity that we can't even imagine with aeronautics and with, you know, what goes on in the skies. So if they say that something strange happens and they have film, you know, they have video, I should say.
Yep.
I mean, that, again, I can't believe that those videos came out and it didn't change the world.
Yeah, it still perplexes me. I sometimes bore my more normal friends by saying I don't understand why you don't get that UFOs are real now. You know, it's there. It's a matter of something weird is going on in the sky. And they're like, yeah,
and
whatever.
All you have to do is look to the New York Times, and there it is.
Yeah,
I mean, if you can't see it there, you can't see it anywhere because you don't believe You don't believe.
Absolutely.
And that again isn't a leg to stand on. Maybe we could do one more case.
Yeah,
and this kind of blends possible possession with poltergeist phenomena as well. Mm. And really the two are very linked because, you know, we were talking about Jeff Holder and he talked about how in the early days people did attribute these kind of strange goings on to demons.
Yes.
You know, one of the person who really popularized the term poltergeist originally was Martin Luther, using it in his religious writings. So these things have been closely aligned, religious religions and poltergeist. So I have a story, again, from Milwaukee, because that's where I'm from. So there were strange events recorded in 1854 in what was called the Mother House here. So we had this huge convent called the Mother House Convent, which spanned four blocks. And the Sisters of Notre Dame were led there by a woman named Carolyn Fryce, Mother Carolyn.
Hmm.
So, you know, Mother Carolyn, you know, did a great job and is known because of that. I mean, not really because of this, but in the history, there's a book that is the history of the convent they had to address some of the strange goings on of the year 1854. So, oh man, there's so much weird stuff in this case. So it was the end of 1854. These manifestations started on the night of December 8th, 1854, as Mother Carolyn Fryce knelt in the darkened chapel. She heard something like scurrying footsteps in the corridor, and then the clatter grew closer to her and became a knocking sound. And then every window in the chapel began to shake. And then suddenly she felt a hand on her arm. And then one of her nuns, it was actually one of her nuns who had run to the chapel from the dormitory to alert Mother Caroline to trouble in the dormitory. So, you know, she's praying in the chapel, and her spidey senses starts tingling, and she gets a feeling that there's a disturbance in the force, you know, and then suddenly there's a hand there. It's one of her nuns saying, "You must come to the dormitory." So in the dormitory, the young candidates for nunhood were really spooked because they were sure that an intruder was lurking somewhere in the shadows there. And Mother Carolyn came quickly to search every corner, but of course, nobody was found. It was difficult to search the location, though, because she literally couldn't shed any light on what was going on. Because mysteriously, the candles and the oil lamps that they used every night would not light and extinguish themselves immediately upon being lit. And this was, you know, really unusual, because in the 19th century, this is what you did all the time. So you had familiarity with how to use candles and oil lamps. So Mother Caroline was forced to peek under beds and snoop in closets, using only the moonlight to help her. But she didn't find any intruder, but she did find what looked like dirty slush on the pillows. And then she went over to where all the nightcaps were lined up. And the same slush was in each of the nightcaps, but they were like turned over on their ends, you know, so, you know, the part where the tassel of the hat is.
Yes.
So how they would stand up, I can't understand. You know, even if it was slush, it didn't act like it was made of water. So it neither soaked through the pillowcases or the nightcaps. As she watched these nightcaps filled with this strange goo, maybe ectoplasm, I don't know. What explanation do we have for what happened next? She couldn't believe her eyes when one of the nightcaps began to jiggle and dance around. So, I mean, this is something that's reported in a religious document. Mm. I mean, this isn't like some, you know, tabloid or some source that is trying to get laughs. It's a serious Catholic publication. And so I was excited to find that this stuff was in there. So other unexplained and ridiculous events drove the sisters to really question their sanity. Yeah. So they had like bread baking in the oven, you know, they put it right in there. They just turn around and then they'd open up the oven again to check on it. And all the loaves were vanished. And where were they? They were floating in the convent cistern.
Yes.
They served supper one night. It was in the oven. They were about to serve the Friday fish fry. And they opened up the oven. And it all transformed into meat. So nobody got any dinner that night. In the closets, The clothing was clawed to shreds as if a hidden beast had gotten at it. And this is a cool one. One night, the altar candles, as they were sitting there in the chapel, so the altar candles just kind of blinked out of existence before everybody's eyes during Mass. So they're there 1 second, everybody's, you know, staring at them, and then all of a sudden they're gone. and they turn up still burning in a broom closet. So, and then later on, Mass was disrupted again when a thunderous uproar of like clanging pots and pans erupted from the nearby kitchen. And the only trouble was no one was in the kitchen. Everybody was accounted for at Mass. So all the pots and the pans had indeed been flung on the floor. And this is an interesting thing, because this has come up before in poltergeist cases. Curiously, when they tried to pick up these pots and pans, they were red hot to the touch. So had you heard that before about, poltergeist, things moved by poltergeist,
yeah,
having a strange temperature attributed to them?
Absolutely. I know when Paul Cropper was stopping at Humpty Doo in Australia, one of the things he noticed was that the stones and things that were being moved around would be warm to the touch. And they even took a thermal image of, I think it was a knife, that was warm all over, which kind of got away from the fact that somebody had been holding it, because obviously that you can't hold it all. So how was it uniformly warm?
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting. See, that this is one of the things that, compels us as researchers when we look at cases that, that case happened in Australia, recently, more recently. And this one, happened in the 1800s in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the USA. But, there are these hallmarks, and, one of that reappear in many cases. And this is one of them where items that were being manipulated by the poltergeist are hot to the touch. Mm. So candidates for nunhood, as the manifestations wore on, started to report that an unseen hand was striking them about the ears and hitting them so hard it knocked their bonnets off. That was like a really good detail I had to include there. And the house dog, who had, very even temperament beforehand, was often seen during this time yowling, as if he was experiencing the same kind of abuse. Mm. And then soon after, the dog just disappeared. So hopefully he just ran away.
Yes, hopefully.
that's what I'm hoping. So Mother Caroline began to lose hope, and everybody was losing sleep due to terrible cries that were echoing through the convent at night. And then dark shapes began to linger in the shadow. So we've got like shadow entities. Then Mother Caroline noticed that one of the young candidates succumbed to uncontrollable fits of laughter every time she entered the chapel. And I mean, this aversion or kind of like inappropriate reaction to religious objects or religious ceremony is thought of as being one of the early signs of demonic possession. And this was just the clue that Mother Caroline had been seeking. So she investigated and found that the young girl who was having those laughing fits had come to the convent to escape an arranged marriage. And although it occurred to Mother Caroline and the convent's priest, Father Urbanek, that the girl might be diabolically possessed, for some unknown reason, she was quickly dismissed. So much for sanctuary. They just threw her out on her ear, and too bad if she's going to be married away in a situation she doesn't want. But in any case, after the girl was cast out, all the manifestations ceased. Mm. So what happened there? What do you think? These manifestations lasted for 13 months. Mm. So, and then after they cast this girl out, even though it doesn't seem like a very Christian thing to do, in my opinion, the Mother Caroline and the sisters declared victory over the devil.
Yeah. So. By default, I would put forward there, Alison. I don't think that's really what you'd count as a victory.
I would agree. But interestingly, the manifestations don't entirely stop there. So year after these, you know, diabolical things were going on, the sisters were awakened at midnight by strange singing and a bright light emanating from the chapel. But this time, Sister Caroline recognized a different presence, and the sisters and even Milwaukee's first bishop, John Martin Henney, witnessed the unmistakable presence of a choir of angels. And in response, what Mother Caroline did was established a chapel of perpetual adoration where nuns prayed in shifts 24/7. So this holy vigil persisted from, you know, what would have been like, I believe, 1856 until 1959. Mm. So when the convent was unfortunately leveled to make way for public housing for the elderly. So for decades they had this tradition afterward where they had nuns that prayed in shifts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in response to this choir of angels that came to visit them. So lots of weird goings on there. And
absolutely.
Now it's a condo building. So. But the bells are still there. You can still visit the bells, which I have done. And yeah. I've actually made the mistake of ringing them as I was standing under them. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it was good fun. It was good fun to get my brain scrambled a bit.
Absolutely, I can imagine. I mean, the one thing that strikes me about some of these most notable cases as well is the fact that people often will say, especially some of the early cases, Alison, are some kind of religious propaganda. But the more poltergeist cases you read, often the presence or arrival of anybody of religious faith tends to incite further response rather than quell it. And I've seen several cases where priests have turned up at houses and just said, well, I'll try and do something, it probably won't work, and it'll just stop when it wants to.
Right. I just throw up my hand. And actually, you know, in the Catholic Church, they don't necessarily think that a building can be possessed of a spirit. The Roman rite of exorcism is for people, not for places.
Yeah.
Typically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One other thing that is slightly related, but I just have to let you know about it because it's so crazy. I can't believe it. So, you know, as I've been doing research on poltergeists and possessions in the Midwest, I was really startled to learn that I thought, okay, to become an exorcist, you had to go to Rome. This is what I thought. And then I found out in my research that there's actually a local organization here in the Midwest that is just an hour. They hold their classes just an hour away from my home in Illinois. It's called the Pope Leo the 13th Institute. And this is a private organization, but they've emerged in response to this tremendous need for exorcism that has arisen in the first few, in the last few years. That there are so many calls for and pleading, there are people pleading for exorcisms that, you know, the Catholic Church felt they needed to respond. So, but they can't meet the need. So an organization like the Pope Leo the 13th Institute emerged. And so now they actually have a seminary in Illinois. As I said, it's in Mundelein, Illinois, which is just an hour from where I am. So I have visited there on many occasions, hoping to spot an exorcist. You know, usually there's nobody outdoors, but the grounds are open. So I do hang around there, look at the angel statuary and whatnot. And they have an incredible library with all kinds of strange works by priests and by exorcists. So I've done a fair amount of research in the library as well. So anyway, at this seminary, you can go, you know, through the auspices of this organization and be trained as an exorcist. Mm. And they have classes going on right now every year. For the last few years, they have offered this for priests from across the nation. And they actually also have an annual exorcism conference where people come from all over the world to listen to leading exorcists speak. But unfortunately, you have to be a priest or a nun or a deacon. Mm. If you are from the general public, they won't let you in. Believe me, I tried. You need to have a letter from your bishop.
Yeah. Oh,
so until I can have a letter from my bishop, I cannot infiltrate. But it's cool to think that there's a week-long summer conference on exorcism and the latest technologies in defeating the devil. Just an hour from my house.
Absolutely. Well, why not? Everybody else seems to have a conference these days, Alison. Why not? If it's good enough for Mothman.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff going on in the Midwest. Not nearly enough is known. So, you know, I do my best in the writing that I do. I have, you know, some books in the works. And I have articles that I've written for different publications. So, I, you know, put as many of these findings into haunted history tours as I can for various communities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm working to get the word out about all the Midwest weirdness that's gone unsung.
Absolutely. So where's the best thing, Alison? So thank you very much for your time. It's been a wonderful trip around America. You've told me a couple of cases that I'd never heard of. So thank you very much.
Great.
And I'll be reading up probably all weekend now. So thank you for that.
Terrific.
So where can everybody keep up to date with your work and find out what else you're up to?
Well, they can definitely check out AmericanGhostWalks.com for information on the tours that we have going on across the country and, you know, even in protectorates and commonwealth like Puerto Rico. So yeah. Check that out, and also check out you might want to check out my YouTube channel as well, which is called youtube.com/mothman. So there's more than just the Mothman on there. I did my own investigation of the Chicagoland Mothman sightings of the past few years. It's a very skeptical investigation, but most of the videos that you'll find there are me actually going to the sites associated with these reports. So people can, you know, get the information from somebody who's actually had boots on the ground and see the environs for themselves. Mm. And find out what matches up with the accounts and what doesn't, and, you know, make their own determination about the veracity of reports or not, based on the facts. So that's why it's called, the Mothman channel, youtube.com/Mothman. But I also have interviews, Skype interviews that I've done with people around the world about their interesting paranormal cases and offerings. So you might want to check that out. You know, I also want to mention something else coming up. I'm not associated with it, but I will be there.
Yeah.
There's an amazing opportunity coming up that is called the Paramook. And that sounds super funny, but Mook, MOOC actually means massively open online classroom. So it sounds funny, but what it is the opportunity for you to see college level presentations live via the internet and participate in the discussion. So they actually have it's starting next week, I believe. You can register on the 13th, and the first workshop presentation is going to be on January 19th. Mm-hmm. But one that is relevant to what we're talking about today is on Sunday, February 16th, they're going to have a presentation on poltergeist phenomena, the psychological aspects, by Brian Williams, who is actually somebody that you want to hear from, because he worked under William Rohl, who was a great poltergeist investigator, who was a professor in North Carolina. So you might want to check out his presentation. He, as I said, worked under William Rohl, who was a very prominent parapsychologist, did a lot of research into poltergeists in particular. And so Brian Williams is now the research director of the Psychical Research Foundation. So do check that out on February 16th. It's absolutely free. You just do it online. Yeah, it's a lecture, so you get to see the presenter. Mm-hmm. And then during the discussion, there's people from around the world logged in, so they're carrying on a discussion as the presentation continues. And then after the presentation, you're actually able to ask the presenter some live questions through that same chat box. So yeah, do check it out, and just Google ParaMOOC 2020.
Okay, brilliant.
And you'll find information.
Fantastic. Well, Alison, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real treat and an honor to finally get you on the show. So thank you for your time today. All right.
Thank you very much. I'm really was really happy to finally talk to you.
Thanks. All the best, Alison.